Hi again, everyone. This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's. I'm joined once again by my friend and colleague, Mark DiGirolami, the center's co-director, for another episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. Well, today, Mark, we're going to talk about a controversy that comes out of the child sex abuse scandal that the country has been suffering through for the last several years. And it's a controversy involving a recent attempt by a California legislator to introduce a bill that would require clergy to reveal certain information that they learn about suspected child abuse, including information that they learn about through the confessional. So this attempt obviously raises some very serious questions about religious liberty under the Constitution, and also, I think, reveals some changing cultural patterns that those of us who study law and religion need to focus on. So what we'd like to do today is first go through a description of the problem, the specific California bill, and then we'll talk a little bit about why we are seeing such bills now, particularly in this cultural moment, and then we'll talk about the constitutionality of such bills. Okay?
Sounds great, Mark.
Okay, so first, I want to talk about the California bill. It was SB 360 that required clergy to report suspected child abuse, including abuse that the clergy learn about through confidential spiritual counseling. So first, I want to give a little bit of background here about the various doctrines that are involved. So almost all states make the clergy mandatory reporters with respect to child abuse. That is, clergy are included on a list of professions, occupations that in their nature will find out about child sex abuse, and the states require these occupations to report suspected abuse to the state authorities.
And that includes people like teachers, for example, and psychiatrists or psychotherapists, right, Mark? I mean, that's a broad set of, and I would imagine states differ one from another with respect to which professions and under what circumstances and what happens to you, all of that kind of stuff, right?
That's correct. So states differ on which occupations are within the category of mandated reporters. I mean, I should say some states have an all-persons statute, which requires anyone who knows about child sex abuse to report it. That's the minority of states. Most states list the occupations, and as I say, these are occupations that you would think have some access to information about child sex abuse, like teachers, like psychotherapists, like social workers, and in most states, like clergy. Now, interestingly, most states say that the mandated reporting requirement with respect to clergy doesn't apply to information that clergy learn about through confidential spiritual counseling. That is, in the traditional Christian communions, is called the sacrament of confession.
So I would think that there are a couple of issues here. One issue concerns a privilege, an evidentiary, testamentary privilege that people would have. And I take it that that's really what's going on here with respect to this California bill. That is, it's not just a general requirement to report, but it involves certain kinds of compulsions to give testimony or privileges not to give testimony that the legislature is thinking about either withdrawing or modifying in some way.
Yeah, so that's correct, Mark. So you have to understand there are two independent doctrines here. One is the mandated clergy reporting requirement that I just mentioned. Then there's another doctrine which goes back centuries in American law, and that is the clergy penitent privilege. And the clergy penitent privilege, you're right, Mark, it's an evidentiary privilege, and it says that clergy cannot be required to testify with respect to confidential spiritual communications. That is, and this is defined differently in different states, but the general category is confidential spiritual counseling. So anything that a clergy member learns about through that is privileged. And of course, the way these interact is several of the states, most of the states actually, that have a mandated clergy reporting requirement say that that requirement does not apply to information that would be covered by the privilege.
So if I can make an analogy, just as there are ethical duties for lawyers, but there's also the attorney-client privilege, just so here. So the attorney-client privilege for lawyers protects communications made in confidence by the client to the lawyer for the purpose of getting legal advice. And that issue involves, and it can be breached in various ways, it can be waived and so on. But then there's a much broader set of ethical duties imposed on lawyers really to keep confidential any kind of information related to the client representation that the lawyer happens to come to, whether or not actually obtained in confidence from the client and so on.
Right, that's correct. And so in all these cases, if the clergy member learns about or suspects child abuse on the basis of information he learns through, not through spiritual counseling, just yes. happens to overhear something, he is required to report this. He or she must report this to the state authorities. The carve-out is for information that would be covered by the clergy penitent privilege.
As an aside, may I just mention that the ethical rule with respect to lawyers protects all of that kind of information, however learned by a lawyer, and that the duty to disclose is in most cases only permissible. It is not required.
Okay, well, that's a difference. Now, it's interesting you bring up the attorney-client confidentiality rules, because those are justified in our system by the idea that it's essential that clients be able to speak candidly with lawyers so that lawyers are able effectively to represent them and so that our justice system can function. The clergy penitent privilege is based on a different rationale. Now, there are several different rationales for this, but the one that appears most in the cases is quite interesting, is this one, which is society has an interest in promoting the relationship between individual believers and their churches. That is, has an interest in promoting organized religion, because organized religion is thought to be good both for individual believers and also for society as a whole. That is the most prominent traditional justification for the clergy penitent privilege. We're going to come back and talk about this. Now, I should say, although most states say that the mandated reporting requirement doesn't apply to the clergy penitent privilege or to information that would violate the clergy penitent privilege, six states do require clergy to report what they learn through confidential spiritual counseling. They are New Hampshire, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Rhode Island, Texas, and West Virginia. So some states already do this, although, as far as I know, there's never been a test case. I don't know of any case in which a clergy member has been prosecuted for failing to do this.
You know, it's interesting, Mark. I wonder whether even in those states, this requirement that you talk about, of what vintage it is, whether, for example, it's a recent development, whether previously states like New Hampshire and others did have the protection but then decided to discard it, or whether this is a kind of a separationist sort of position, the separation of church and state, that they've just for many years adopted a policy like this one. Be curious to actually know that information.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I don't know it offhand, but yeah. It would be interesting to go back and find it. Okay, so, and I should say, the punishment for a clergy member who fails to report this information, it's, in most jurisdictions, it's a misdemeanor. So a few months in prison or a fine, I mean, that's what it,
I would,
what
think
it would be.
Contempt of court, maybe?
Contempt of court, right.
Yeah.
Although I want to highlight again for our listeners, I don't know of any case in which a state has actually tried to do this, but this is at least the law. Okay, that's the background. This year, last winter in California, a state legislator, he's a Democratic legislator from the Bay Area, introduced a bill in California. Now, California at the moment makes clergy members mandated reporters, but carves out information covered by the clergy penitent privilege, which in California is defined to mean information that a clergy member gathers in conversations that his own church requires him to keep confidential. So it's really, and by the way, it's a clergy member from a recognized denomination.
That's interesting, too.
Right. So it's pretty narrowly defined privilege. Anyway, Senator Hill from the Bay Area introduced a bill to remove that exemption from the mandated reporting requirements. And so the bill, SB 360, would say that the mandated reporting requirement does extend to information that would be covered by the clergy penitent privilege, as long as it relates to communications from clergy and other church personnel.
Very, that's extraordinary.
Yes, yeah. It's very narrow. So if a clergy member hears something in a confidential spiritual setting from a layperson, that is still exempt from reporting. But if the clergy member hears something in a confidential spiritual communication from another clergy member or from certain other personnel in the clergy member's church, then he has to reveal it. Now, what was that all about? Senator Hill made very plain...
I'll give you three guesses what it was about.
Well, Senator Hill made very plain in statements as part of the legislative history that he was most concerned about clergy protecting other clergy, that is to say, clergy protecting clergy who have been accused of child abuse, And specifically, even more, he was concerned about the Catholic Church.
So this is part of the legislative record, you know, specific comments with respect to the Catholic Church.
This is part of the, right. So Senator Hill revealed that he had been motivated by the Pennsylvania grand jury report, which revealed quite extensive allegations of abuse in various Pennsylvania Catholic dioceses. He was also influenced by the reports about Cardinal McCarrick that came out earlier this year, which showed that Cardinal McCarrick had engaged in sexual abuse even while he was the point person for the American Catholic Church on sex abuse cases. And so he said the record of the Catholic Church, that is Senator Hill, said the record of the Catholic Church in this matter was gruesome. It was the only institution that he mentioned by name, and he really felt the situation had to be addressed. Now, that bill, his bill, passed the California State Senate by a vote of 30-4, which is, I don't know how the California Senate operates. That's a pretty
overwhelming
margin. At that point, Catholics in California, as well as other church and religious groups in California and religious liberty advocates, got involved. They had a huge campaign. Hundreds of thousands of emails were sent in to the California legislature, thousands of phone calls. And Senator Hill withdrew his bill because it looked like this was not going to pass the assembly. I say he withdrew it. He didn't actually withdraw the bill. He just said it's on hold. So he asked that the legislature stop considering it for now, but he made plain he was going to keep working. Now, given the public outcry, and it, for those of you who follow these things, you know it was all over the internet, this opposition to this bill is probably dead in California. But I don't think, Mark, that we can say this issue is dead more generally.
Well, no, I think certainly the general horror at the child sex abuse allegations in religious institutions in general, and specifically with respect to the Catholic Church, is still very much with us. There are new allegations and new scandals that seemingly appear every day. There are attempts, obviously ongoing attempts by the church to work through some of these problems. Whether those are going to be sufficient or the actual extent and depth of the problem really hasn't been fully fleshed out yet. So it would not surprise me at all that we would see not only renewed efforts in California, but efforts elsewhere. Now we'll talk about exactly whether this particular kind of effort is permissible or whether it's the right sort of approach more broadly. But in general, these kinds of restrictive approaches are likely to increase.
Yeah, well, I mean, so in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report, we now have something like 20 states have begun their own independent investigations. I mean, it's interesting, Mark, the Pennsylvania grand jury report really does seem to have reignited the furor over this. Of course, in America, the furor over child sex abuse goes back to 2002, 2003, with the spotlight. Spotlight investigation of the Massachusetts Catholic Church by the Boston Globe. But it did seem to me, at least, that the church had been trying to work its way through that. They had a number of reforms. I'm sure they didn't satisfy everybody, but it looked like the church at least had turned the corner. And then the Pennsylvania grand jury report totally blew it all open again. Now, we should say, in the interest of fairness, you know, it's wrong to think of child sex abuse as simply a problem in religious institutions. In fact, there are some indications that there's more abuse in the public schools in America. And, you know, sadly, experts say that most abuse takes place in the home, not in a church, not in a school. But the problem within churches is nonetheless a real one. And as I say, I think the Pennsylvania grand jury report has just blown it all open again.
Now, that's not really, I wouldn't think, the only reason I would think that one would expect these kinds of bills or these kinds of efforts to increase, or you expect to see more of them as time goes on. Right, Mark? I mean, you've done a little bit of work on this. And as you mentioned earlier, if one of the primary justifications for the privilege was that it was thought good that congregants and members of churches have a space with which they could intercede with clergy members and be part of religious institutions and so on. All of those kinds of assumptions, social and cultural assumptions, those are under a lot of pressure too.
Yes, that's quite right, Mark. So you're right. We said a little while ago that the clergy penitent privilege has been justified traditionally by society's interest in promoting ties between individual believers and their religious institutions. It is a basically pro-organized religion doctrine. And you can see that in California, which, after all, extends the privilege only to clergy from recognized denominations.
It's actually amazing. You know, I remember a while back when we were doing some comparative law and religion work, and and you look at some of the arrangements that France has or Italy has, and Americans are very quick to jump on those at, oh, how could you possibly grant status and so on to certain recognized institutions? Well, you know what? We've got it here in sort of the sub-doctrines, maybe not as officially recognized churches in the way that they do it, but we do have it with respect to some of these privileges and lower level, so to speak, doctrines, where you have to draw the line someplace. I mean, it's sort of a practical problem that all governments are going to have to face.
Sure, absolutely. And this assumption kind of fits with traditional American understandings of religion. Religion has been, you know, notwithstanding what many of our colleagues talk about, say, with regard to separationism and, you know, strict neutrality and equality, religion really has been favored in American law because religion has been favored in American culture generally. I mean, our sense in America has been traditionally religion is by and large a good thing. That's why we have tax benefits for religious institutions.
And organized religion.
And yes.
Organized and sort of established, traditionally established religions.
Correct. But our culture is changing on this, perhaps. Everyone, I'm sure, has heard, everyone who listens to this podcast has heard of the rise of the nuns, which is a great disaffiliation that's been occurring since 1990. Something like a fifth of Americans today say that they have no religious affiliation. When you talk about younger Americans, it's well over a third, at least according to the Pew survey, now say they have no religious affiliation. Some scholars, like Rodney Stark, think that's a little overstated, but most scholars would say it's a real phenomenon. And if that's true, then it's hard to see how the traditional justification for the privilege retains its force, because you have substantial numbers of Americans who now do not have a connection with organized religion. And if they do have a connection, they find it objectionable, organized religion. So you have to think that that is also part of what's going on here. The idea that we should have a privilege in order to protect religious institutions, in order to promote religious institutions, that is going to be very unpersuasive to increasing numbers of Americans, especially younger Americans.
And you can compare the extensive and very generous privileges that we grant to attorneys, for example, attorneys and clients, the solicitude with which we expect lawyers to guard client confidences. All of those are undergirded by common cultural assumptions that these are good relationships, that we want to foster these kinds of relationships, and that it's very important that clients and lawyers be able to exchange information freely, trust one another, and so on. Take away those assumptions and you would have a similar sort of problem, it seems to me, there too. But those assumptions are very strong.
Right. Now, you know, I want to point out, I'm not saying that we're about to get rid of the clergy penitent privilege, because even though a substantial number of Americans will be suspicious of organized religion, there are still a substantial plurality of Americans who are committed to traditional organized religion, and they are likely to support. In fact, you saw this in California, in which SB 360 was opposed not only by the Catholic, very vociferously by the Catholic Church, but not only the Catholic Church, Orthodox Christians, mainline Protestant groups, groups from other religions rallied around this. So I think what you're going to see now is that this privilege is going to become yet another point of contention in our increasingly fractious culture.
Very interesting, Mark. So maybe we can just talk about the constitutionality of the California bill, because we haven't really talked about this seemingly extraordinary to me targeting of the withdrawal of the privilege only with respect to confidential communications under seal by other clergy members.
Or right? Church personnel.
Or church personnel. That's
right.
Interesting.
The
it's
church
not
secretary.
Just clergy, but right. Interesting.
Anybody
okay.
who has some internal knowledge of what's going on.
Got it.
So, right. So let's talk about the constitutionality of this bill. The law of, and this would be basically a religious exemption question. The argument would be that clergy should be exempt from the reporting requirement with respect to this kind of information. The law with respect to religious exemptions, Mark, you and I have talked about this before. It's a bit of a moving target. At least let's just limit ourselves to the First Amendment in the interest of time. I mean, we're not going to talk about state RFRAs or state constitutions, just the U.S. Constitution. Under a case called Employment Division versus Smith from 1990, where a law is neutral and generally applicable, where it applies neutrally and in a generally applicable way, there is no right to a religious exemption. There's a lot of debate over what those terms mean, neutral and generally applicable, but neutral is thought to be doesn't target religion, doesn't single out religion for disfavored treatment. And generally applicable means it's not under-inclusive. That is, if it covers religiously motivated conduct, it also covers analogous conduct that is motivated by non-religious reasons. So if we apply that here, you know, you never know, but it seems pretty clear to me this is not a neutral bill.
Well, I think I agree with that. I mean, it's targeting both as a matter of text and as a matter of the legislative history that you talked about, either religion generally, because it's targeting either confessions by clergy and or church personnel, or the Catholic Church specifically, if we look to the comments that you're talking about in the legislative history. So on the neutrality point, I think after cases like Masterpiece Cake Shop and so on, we're going to have trouble, don't you think, Mark?
I think so. I mean, I think this is sort of analogous. So Masterpiece Cake Shop is the case from last year in which the court said that the Colorado State Civil Rights Commission had displayed bias towards a religious claimant. There were some very unfortunate comments in the record. And the court said, in an opinion by Justice Kennedy, that alone was enough to make out a free exercise clause violation. Now, in a case coming up this term, perhaps, there's a cert petition, a case called Arlene's Flowers. There's an argument about whether the non-neutral comments have to come from an adjudicator or could come from a legislator. So there's some question about this, but I think Senator Hill was very clear that he was targeting the Catholic Church. In fact, it's sort of astounding to me that we've reached a point in American political culture where just as a political matter, Senator Hill would think that's a good thing to say that won't get him in trouble.
Right. No, I mean, it sort of testifies to the power of the grand jury report that you mentioned out of Pennsylvania. But how about this, Mark? Let's perhaps play with the statute a little bit and create hypotheticals, because we said, okay, on neutrality is probably out. Even on general applicability, the way that the statute is phrased, it doesn't seem generally applicable. But that raises a question for me. Suppose the requirement were phrased in more general terms. Suppose it required breaking the seal for testimonial purposes generally for all child abuse reporting. Would that also be unconstitutional? I mean, you said that six states are already doing this.
Right.
Now, who knows whether that's been challenged or not, but it still seems to me that is, unless the testimonial privileges in analogous situations are not also being breached, then at least it seems to me there's an argument that the requirement being imposed is not generally applicable. No?
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I think it would be different. It would be an easier case for the state to make if it said this extends to all information clergy members get, or if they say everyone has to report something, right?
Right.
I think that would be easier. Under Smith, it would seem to me in a case like that, there really wouldn't be. Let me put it this way. I think, Mark, that the case under Smith for an exemption would be harder if the statute were not targeting particular suspected perpetrators who happen to be clergy members. That's true. I think it'd be harder to make a case for a religious accommodation there, but not necessarily impossible.
Right. Well, the issue of neutrality depends. I'm having a little bit of a hard time thinking through whether the issue of neutrality goes to the confessor or the person who's confessing. In other words, I would assume it would be both, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want a law tinkering with or eliminating the testimonial privileges either that is targeting a particular group that is receiving information or that is giving information. So I think both would arguably be problematic.
I agree with that. And look, so we have, it seems to me, a couple of possibilities. One is that you could have a state say, here are certain categories of mandated reporters. It's not everybody, it's only some. But with respect to those mandated reporters, you have to say everything you hear, there is no exception.
Right.
Now, in a case like that, I think one could argue that if there are other exceptions here, so for example, mandated reporters include clergy, but they don't include attorneys.
Right.
Then I think you have a question whether this is a generally applicable law. And if it isn't, then I think we move to the compelling interest test, which we'll get to in just a second. On the other hand, you could have a statute that says everybody has to say it. There is no exception at all for anybody. It's not by category. It's anybody who gets information about child abuse has to reveal it. And some states have that law.
Mm.
In that case, I think it would be hard to make out a claim that it's not generally applicable. And
this applies to everybody.
Applies to everybody. Now, let's continue with our little hypothetical here. Let's assume we have a situation like California's that there are categories of mandated reporters. Clergy are included, no exception, but not everyone's included. Let's say attorneys are kept out, and it's quite striking. Of course, Mark and I are both attorneys, and most legislators are attorneys. It's quite interesting that the attorneys get to keep their...
Always. All right, no, the lobby is very strong.
The lobby is very strong. So in a case like that, assuming that we get to the compelling interest analysis, how would this play out? So the compelling interest analysis is this. The state must have a compelling interest that justifies the substantial burden it is placing on a person's religious exercise, and there must be no lesser means of doing it. That is, in other words, the statute must be the least restrictive means of achieving that compelling interest. So, Mark, if that's the test, how do you think a case would come out?
Hard to know, but I would think the compelling interest here is pretty compelling. I mean, so the needing to know information about child abuse. But of course, the compelling interest is always evaluated against, as you say, the least restrictive means. And in this case, you can always ask questions, just how compelling is the interest in knowing about or getting information about child abuse as opposed to some other kind of interest like, you know, sticking it to religion or sticking it to traditional religion or sticking it to the Catholic Church. Supposing that one is not making the reporting requirement, if that's what it is, or that one is not requiring a breach of the testimonial privilege, if that's what it is. Remember, these are two different issues generally. The suspicion, the more exceptions you have, the more suspicion is generated that, well, the interest that you claim that is compelling, that's not really the interest, because if it were, then you would be you wouldn't be making exceptions. So,
or Mark, I may say, it's not really compelling, because if it were
exactly.
so compelling, you'd have everybody in. You know, very interestingly, Doug Laycock and also Professor Duncan at Nebraska have made the argument that really what you have here is that the law insists that religion be given a sort of most favored nation treatment. So those of you who follow international trade law know the most favored nation principle is that a country gets the same trade concessions as the most favored nation. So if you're going to give an exception for some people, like lawyers don't have to report, that's the most favored nation. And so clergy have to get at least that level of protection. And
yeah,
that's an interesting way to think about these cases.
Well, I take it that the six states that have imposed the requirements on clergy but not on other sorts of professional people and so on would not satisfy the most favored nation.
Yeah,
status,
they're failing. Right? So look, we'll have to see how this all plays out. But we did think it's a useful issue to think about, even if we don't know all the answers right now. So that wraps up this podcast. Listeners, we'd like you to stay tuned because we're going to be addressing some other very important issues soon involving cases. Well, there's more cases involving wedding vendors and same-sex marriage, and there's some other cases too.
There's an abortion case that the Supreme Court just picked up that we'll be talking about. So it's going to be a very active fall and winter season. We hope that you'll be able to stay with us and listen to us.
Great. So stay tuned. This has been another episode of Legal Spirits. You can find past episodes archived on iTunes and also at our website, Law and Religion Forum. That's one word, lawandreligionforum.org. Thanks for listening.